And as soon as he said that, you know, I actually felt physically sick, because that meant that this, you know, even with a lockdown, like if we'd continued the November lockdown, we would almost certainly have continued to have increasing numbers of cases, increasing number of hospitalizations, and increasing numbers of deaths. And
by the way, we are seeing those now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. Yeah. And so it was extraordinarily worrying.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Backstory. I'm Dana Lewis. I started this podcast in the spring under lockdown, and it's been a fantastic outlet to interview and hear some amazing people. This is our last podcast of 2020. We're under lockdown in London, so I guess it ends as it started. Tonight is New Year's, and hopefully 2021 is a better year for everyone. As we speak, my kids will not be going back to school in London this week because school openings are delayed. Hospitals are overwhelmed here and in America and in other parts of Europe. The COVID-19 virus has been relentless, and now it is adapting and becoming more dangerous because a new variant makes it spread faster. We're talking about 70% faster, according to the experts. This week, Oxford AstraZeneca announced they have been approved as a vaccine, the third big vaccine after Pfizer's and Moderna. This one is easier to transport, cheaper to buy. But is this new variant of COVID-19 spreading in the UK, in Europe, and Canada, and the US now, resistant to vaccines? Well, they say probably not, but we can tell you behind the scenes, tests are being carried out at government labs, and we will know more in a couple of weeks. But we are in a race, say experts, to get the pandemic under control with vaccines before this virus mutates again. And it will. On this Backstory, we speak to a professor of medicine, Dr. Paul Hunter, here in the UK. He's a virologist, but first we go to the US. And an epidemiologist who has been publicly critical of the Trump administration's handling of the pandemic. There's been a lot of people that have been critical. Which, by the way, and by any estimation, was downplayed politically by Trump to win an election. He lost the election, and the virus just keeps on coming. All right, joining me now from Washington is Dr. Eric Fingelding, who is an epidemiologist, a health economist. He's well known. He does a lot of television, by the way. And Eric, you know, you appeared in this ad really against President Trump with a lot of other healthcare people, doctors who were really concerned about the pace of the spread of COVID-19 in the United States, as most people are. Why did you do that ad?
Well, I felt like public policy around public health has really failed in terms of leadership in leading the country. And so much that we know about masks, so much what we know about lockdowns, so much what we know about testing, contact tracing, being early to stop the pandemic. So many public health recommendations were ignored. And literally, we've never been in a situation where an election came down to life and death for thousands, tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands of people as quickly unfolding the last few months and into the coming months. So I felt really compelled as a public health scientist to really act and advocate.
Well, I'm glad you acted with good conscience. But why do you think that President Trump ignored kind of that side of the discussion to a large degree and downplayed the virus, constantly saying we're rounding a corner, the vaccines are coming? It, you know, from the moment this started breaking out in the United States, he was trying to close the door and say we have it under control and it's going away. Why?
Right. Well, the key thing for his reelection, he thought, according to a lot of strategists, is that the economy must be booming. As long as the economy is booming, that was his path to reelection. And obviously, the coronavirus pandemic has thrown a huge monkey wrench to that, given all the economic damage that it has done. And he thought early on that the longer he just tried to downplay it, ignore it, just trying to tell people it's a hoax, that it would somehow dampen people's anxiety and, again, not cause people to get worried and therefore change their behaviors and hurt the economy.
Keep he thought that the stock
ignoring that he could win in that way for his reelection. But the virus is will do its virus thing. It does not care about political beliefs whatsoever. It will transmit at every single opportunity that you give it to transmit, whether it's airborne, whether it's not wearing masks, whether it's not distancing, whether they're not taking any public health precautions, not testing contact tracing. This is why the virus is really agnostic of politics. And in that kind of dimension, Trump just, his mindset just could not deal with this pandemic.
All right, it's important time frame in how long this virus is let to run loose in some regard. Is it not? Because now that enters us into this new conversation about a new variant, which I want to ask you about. But the longer this virus is around, the more it's going to change and adapt and become vaccine resilient, is it not?
Well, vaccine resiliency, vaccine escape is a little bit more tricky. We don't think that this will escape the vaccine, but you are right that the longer this virus circulates in nature, that it has a host or reservoir of whether it's humans or animals to replicate, pass on, and in these hosts mutate. The longer that keeps happening, the more and more of these mutations, these chance unlucky mutations that we will see. And so this is why we have to really eradicate. Zero COVID should be the goal, because with zero COVID, we can eradicate it for good and return to complete normal. But with this semi-lockdown, keep the embers as long as it's almost gone, you know, that's half willy-nilly approach will not end this virus. It will allow it to become endemic for long term and mutate more and more forms. And we just cannot afford that.
Here in the United Kingdom, but also where you are in the United States, that does appear to be the approach, though. As long as the hospitals can deal with the inflow of patients, then you kind of release some of the restrictions, let businesses open again and movie theaters and salons. And then the moment it looks like they're about to be overwhelmed again, they start locking down. And that's what we're experiencing here in London. Because of this new development with the virus, they are locking down and starting to get pretty panicked. But they're never going for what you talk about, this kind of zero approach to the virus.
Yeah, my best analogy is, look, if you're owner of Jurassic Park, and you know what, you've almost eliminated all the velociraptors. But welcome to the park, kids. Come to the park. No one's going to come to the park. And same with if it was a zoo. The full economic demand and marginal propensities to consume and all these things in economics, they will not return until you have completely eliminated this virus. This virus is just that pernicious, just that easy way to basically transmit, that it will really stall out our economic development in so many different ways and hurt our children in so many ways. So other than the vaccine strategy, which I cannot, you know, emphasize is so important, but isn't coming fast enough given the pace of inoculations, zero COVID should be the goal. And really, to truly stamp it out so that it's never a menace to us again, you really have to aim for that. And with the hospital criteria, it's so dumb. Look, if that was the criteria for everything, you know what? You don't need to wear helmets. Our hospital beds are not full. You don't need, seatbelt laws. Our hospital beds are not full. That's not how public health works. You reduce risk every single way you can. And this is for the same reason. I think secondhand smoke is a good analogy. Secondhand smoke actually hurts and causes cancer and heart disease and deaths in other people, right? That's why it's banned in restaurants and bars. And this hurting of other people, this we have to take this prevention model and the community model. Truly, we need to in order to guarantee economic development, we need to stop this virus for good. And we need to think of the collective good and not just think of, oh, are the hospital beds full or not. Really, we really have to focus on zero COVID as the goal.
How concerned are you about this new variant that they've traced back to at least starting here in the United Kingdom, especially in the southeast and around London where I am to September, they think. And it has, quote unquote, by the government, taken off. How concerned are you? Is this just another variant in some 4,000 variants? Or would you say, no, this is a lot more significant?
Yeah, we've had a lot of variants, but this is significant given that the number of mutations is accumulated is huge. It's like a huge jump, step up from the average rate of mutation. And it's in the spike protein and in the binding domains, which means it can likely modify how this virus functions. And this increased transmissibility anywhere between 50 and 70% is worrisome. That said, it doesn't change how we, our public health guidelines are. We know how to stop this virus. It's basically wear masks, take distance precautions, but that's not enough. Take airborne precautions because this is the airborne virus and hence ventilate and do all these testing, contact tracing. All of these things don't change. These strategies still work. The problem is this virus just moves so much faster if these public health containment measures are not in place. And no one wants a lockdown. I don't want a lockdown. No one wants a lockdown. That's a last resort. But unless we can do all these proper public health things, lockdown is the only way to go. And obviously that hurts a lot of people. So it doesn't change in, per se what we should be doing. It just changes the urgency. And I think the increased risk of transmission in children, that speculation also increases the urgency that if we want our kids to go back to school in the near future, we really have to get this under control.
All right, that's what I want to ask you about, because up until now, it's been gauged here and in other parts of the United States that it's more important to keep schools open than it is to keep kids away from COVID, because they don't generally get a lot of big reactions to it, or they're asymptomatic. But no doubt it is spreading amongst kids. And this new variant appears to be, based on initial reports, and I understand studies are still going on, and you don't have firsthand studies in front of you right now, but what do you think, how do you interpret that data that you're starting to see about its ability to spread with kids, and what does that mean to school openings, which are just around the corner?
Right. And I think this is one of the factors that really worries me, because this transmissibility, people have downplayed it in children for the longest time. Now, granted, children don't die at a high rate, but they do get sick, do get hospitalized, and some, of course, unfortunately, do die. But this is only more important for our kids, because if it is true, if it is preliminary data is true, that this elevates the transmission risk among kids to the level of adults, which is what they're speculating. This means that children are efficient vectors as adults. And that means schools will become much more dangerous of a place. Now, obviously, of all the things to open, the last things to close down should be schools. And so I would rather close down bars and restaurants before I close schools. But this really changes the ballgame around schools. And this emphasizes that stopping the virus, ultimately stopping the virus through vaccinations or through these other public health containment measures, testing, contact tracing, masks, ventilation, airborne precautions, it just takes on a level of urgency I cannot emphasize enough. And people are just also ignoring the fact that it's airborne. This wash your hands is important in the early days, but yeah. I think wash your hands, it's still important, but not nearly as important to ventilate and not nearly as important as, you know, using advanced MERV 13 filters, germicidal UV for office buildings and newer schools. All these things take on a new level of urgency, unfortunately. And if So if this variant holds out true, which is now detected in like dozens of countries worldwide, it is very worrisome for our kids going back to school.
Do you think it's much more widespread than we realize? Because UK is very, very good at analyzing, like 100 times better at doing genome sequencing and studying the development of the virus. Do you think that there's just a lot of other countries that just haven't recognized how widespread this is already in their populations?
Yeah, absolutely. And remember the old adage, no testing, no cases, no pandemic. Well, in this situation, it's no genomic sequencing, no mutations, no new variants. It's this, and it's a very backwards, you know, see no evil, hear no evil, but is there truly evil? We don't know. And US is ranked number 43 in the world in terms of percentage of total cases sequenced, virus cases sequenced. So we're really behind the ball game here. And we think it could already be behind. Remember, in the spring, we had discovered that we were 2 months behind the identification of the early Washington state cases because we were lacking testing in January and February. So this is the worry, that it's already here, it's already circulating. Now, it's not more deadly or virulent than the previous strains. But again, what makes this virus so unique is that it doesn't kill everyone really quickly, because if you do, like Ebola with 50% mortality, this virus wouldn't take over the world. It spreads perniciously, kills a lot of people, but also harmlessly passes through many. And this harmlessly passing through many because of its contagiousness is what gives it the pernicious property to take on the world as a pandemic. So we have to stop it. And we have to take a whole no prisoner, zero COVID approach. Because those countries that have, New Zealand, Taiwan, Australia, and also China and Vietnam, they've enjoyed hundreds of days of no community transmissions for the most part, and no deaths. And they're having concerts, sports games. Their life is basically returned to normal. And they have not paid any further price beyond the initial lockdown period. But we are constantly paying it again and again with multi-trillion dollar relief bills that we can't afford in the long term. We have to do it, and we have to stop it now.
Editorial in The Garden by an Anthony Costello, who's a professor of global health and sustainable development at University College here in London, says, don't blame the new development with the virus for where we are. He says the prime minister's repeated dithering, delays, and seeming inability to make unpopular decisions have led Britain to one of the worst death rates in the world. We can only hope that we're not in that position by Easter. He says there's a lot of parallels between what's happened in Britain and what has happened under President Trump.
Yeah, absolutely. And I agree. The most of the global cases, hospitalizations, and deaths are not due to the new variant. The new variant is still a small minority of the total viruses that's circulating. And, it really is a show of how big a difference good leadership makes. In New Zealand, Jacinda Ardern, her leadership allowed huge move fast and take the precautionary principle. Taiwan did the same thing as well. Taiwan's vice president is actually a Johns Hopkins trained epidemiologist. They moved fast. They didn't blink when it came to how bad this could be. They knew that they had to get it under control. And that takes leadership, decisiveness. If you want to be sure, 100% sure before you act, you will be too late, as WHO Emergency Director Mike Ryan said. This is why good leadership in these times of crisis makes all the difference. This is not like a hurricane that's already blown through. This is an active storm that is still raging, and the faster you can stop it, the faster you can enjoy life again.
Last question to you. What is the risk? And I don't want to over dramatize it, but it seems to me in everything that I've read that you've already talked about the new variant changing somewhat the development of the spike protein, which is what the vaccines are designed to cling onto and attack. If we dither, to use somebody else's words again, if this goes on with us just kind of letting the steam out of the lockdowns and then locking down a bit more and then letting it run again, run hot, isn't there a danger that these vaccines that we need so badly at a certain point will get outpaced by COVID-19, which is constantly adapting to its environment?
Yeah, this coronavirus, it's not as fast mutating as, say, the flu, but it does mutate over time. And the longer we let it linger, especially for many, many years, there will be vaccine escape to some degree. It won't be, you know, right now, say Moderna, Pfizer, 95% efficacy. It won't be that it drops to zero, but it could drop significant percentages the more mutations it has. Now, we're doing lab studies right now to show how much our antibodies resist that we develop from this vaccine will attack this new variant. And some people say it probably won't affect much, at most a few percentage points drop. But the longer we let it roam free, the more it will pick up these resistance. And I use the word resistance because it's slightly, not exactly, but slightly akin to antibiotic resistance, right? You use more ways to attack it, especially certain drugs like monoclonal antibodies, which people speculate it could be use of monoclonal antibodies in an immunocompromised person. But the more you attack the virus, the more it'll try ways to evade you. And the more time and more bodies in which it can live for a while to mutate, the greater the risk that this could happen. And that is what we ultimately don't want. Now, granted, we can modify the mRNA vaccines pretty quickly. We had this vaccine we are administering now back in February. We can synthesize pretty fast, but the trials would take so long and take so much effort and time, and we will lose a lot of cases, and we will go through more of these openings, lockdowns that the pandemic is not controlled. We have to stop it now. And the vaccine thing, you know, it's a more of a multi-year thing if it becomes a significant vaccine escape. But that should not be the consideration right now. Consideration right now is we have to stop it for a whole collective of public health, children's educational, and economic reasons. And long term, if we do not stop it in 2021, 2022, if we let it keep roaming, then the vaccine escape will really catch up with us in a few years. And that's what we ultimately definitely want to avoid as well.
All right, Dr. Eric Figelding, very good to talk to you, and an epidemiologist and health economist. And I will confess, I've been trying to get him for more than a week. He's a busy guy and in high demand, so we really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Best wishes.
Thank you, sir. All right, let's go to Norwich, England, in East Anglia. The Norwich School of Medicine is at the University of East Anglia, and Dr. Paul Hunter is a professor in medicine. Hi, Paul.
Hello. Good afternoon.
You are a virologist?
Yeah, my medical specialty. I graduated in medicine, then I specialized in medical microbiology and virology. But a lot of my career has been are also involved in public health aspects of infectious disease.
You probably never thought we would be in this situation.
Well, actually, one of my old medical students sent me an email a couple of months back saying that he can remember a lecture that I gave about 10, 15 years ago now, where I was predicting pretty much that we would have something like this at some time in their working career. So
It's one thing to predict it. It's quite another one to face it. And I mean, did you really believe that when you kind of looked statistically and said, yeah, well, I mean, we're probably due every century or so?
Yeah, no, absolutely. Because, for most of my professional career, we've been experiencing one or two what's called emerging infectious disease threats a year. And it was only really a matter of time before we had a big one like this. I mean, we've had, in the last few years, we've had Ebola in West Africa, Zika virus in South America, avian influenza, swine flu, all sorts of other threats, SARS and MERS. And so they come about one or two a year on average. And it was only a matter of time before we had one as big as this. And as the World Health Organization said a couple of days ago, you know, this might not actually be the big one.
Well, they're full of good news.
Yeah, absolutely.
It may not actually be the big one because they're expecting something that's much stronger than this virus.
It could well be the case. I mean, we're heading for about 2 million deaths totally so far with this pandemic. And Spanish flu, there was, I think I'm right in saying there was something like 50 million deaths worldwide. And it's possibly only a matter of time before, again, we have something that even dwarfs this. But hopefully
we seem so utterly ill-prepared for all of it. Look, as we speak, let's start off on a positive. Oxford AstraZeneca has announced now that their vaccine has been approved.
Indeed.
So we have yet another big vaccine out of three big ones now. Would you take it? Do you think this is great news or?
Yeah, I mean, I think
moderately pleased.
I think it is. I think the three main vaccines at the moment, and for the West at least, but there are others. There's the Russian Sputnik vaccine, and China's got its own vaccine, which is again is slightly different to the mRNA vaccines for Pfizer, Moderna, and the adenovirus vector vaccines.
How is this one different than the Pfizer and the Moderna?
Well, it's delivered within a pre-existing virus, which is, for the Oxford one, it's a chimpanzee virus. And that gets into the cells, and then the DNA is released, and then then that cell manufactures the spike protein, which is what you're trying to gender the immunity to. The Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are what's called mRNA vaccines. So essentially what you're doing is injecting messenger RNA into little packages that then get taken up and then get replicated into the protein. And so ultimately the end result is the same, but there are many different issues in how you handle these different vaccines, certainly.
I don't know many mainstream people that don't have concerns about the safety of the vaccines. Even traditional people that generally say, yeah, you know, vaccines are fine, they give them to their kids. These have been rolled out so quickly in such a compressed period of time. I mean, there are still a lot of concerns with some pretty sober people. I mean, these are not anti-vaxxers, but just generally people who are worried about, you know, do you take it or do you wait a while?
Yeah, I mean, I've got no hesitation. You know, I'm just desperately looking to the opportunity to have my shots, which the last time I looked might not be till April, May, although with the Oxford vaccine coming out. I think this issue about the speed is that these have got to market. When you realize what the reasons for the delays are normally, then it becomes less frightening. The issue with most vaccines is that when you're developing a new vaccine to any disease, the first thing is you're never sure it's going to work. So what happens is that you persuade somebody to fund your initial research to show in that you can develop a vaccine and that maybe, and then go on to show that it works possibly in animal experiments. And then once you've got those, you write those up and you then go through another round of persuading somebody to fund the phase one studies, which if they're successful, you fund the second phase two studies. And the other thing is that for most infectious diseases that you're trying to develop vaccines to, you don't have actually that much disease around, so that even when you do get to phase three trials, it takes a long time to accumulate enough cases in your study for you to be able to judge the efficacy of the vaccine. What's happened here is that effectively all these manufacturers, all these vaccine producers were funded up front for the whole thing. They so they didn't, once they'd completed the phase one studies, they could, they didn't then have to go begging for money to do the next bit. And also because of that, they were able to overlap the different studies so that as soon as you've got preliminary data showing that phase one, it's safe, you can then pretty much quickly go on to the phase two studies and so on. So all the steps have been gone through.
Am I right in saying that with the Oxford AstraZeneca and maybe with the others too, that because we are in the middle of a pandemic, and especially in the United Kingdom where you have a national healthcare system, they were very quick in getting it out to people, having the right people take it for their studies and being able to get those results back?
Yes, yeah. And importantly, having those right people actually get sick. Because you know, you only know that a vaccine has worked once people start getting sick in your study. And then what happens is that once you've got enough people who have actually developed the disease, you break the code and see whether or not the people who've developed the disease have been in, have had the vaccine or a placebo. And that's why the phase three studies, which typically can take several years to complete, have been able to get through quite quickly.
As we speak, there are a lot of people sick. And there are record numbers of people sick in America, sick in Europe, United Kingdom. It's probably very close to leading the death toll in Europe again. This new variant, and Paul, that's really what I wanted to talk to you about. Are you alarmed by the new variant?
Oh, desperately so.
And why?
I can remember one of the days that I will remember most about the epidemic was in part because it shocked me and I wasn't expecting it, was when the Prime Minister gave his presentation about a week, a Saturday it was about a week before Christmas, about this new variant.
And it's not very long ago. It seems this news cycle, it seems like it was a long time ago. It was just a week before Christmas, and that was 72 hours after he had come out and said it would be inhuman to create a lockdown through Christmas.
Absolutely. And what he said was that, and his second sentence was effectively that, as far as they can tell, the new variant has an R value of more than 0.4 over the pre-existing variants. Now, we're hoping to publish this soon, but we've been looking at how effective the November lockdown was. And generally, it was pretty effective, it must be said, in terms of suppressing the virus. And most regions were able to get down on average to about an R value of 0.7 for their epidemics.
You know, Paul, there's a lot of people that don't understand the R value, especially in America, because it's talked about in news conferences here all the time. But the R value essentially is, if it's an R value of one, that means you infect one other person. If it's 1.5, you're infecting one and a half, you're passing it on. So it's got to be below one.
It's got to be below one.
Yes.
Now, so the simple maths was, if our November lockdown was able to get the existing variants down to an R value of 0.7, and this new variant was 0.4, that takes it above one. And so what essentially that said was that the November lockdown was not sufficient to reverse the increase in this new variant, which is very scary. And that means that, and as soon as he said that, I felt actually felt physically sick, because that meant that this, you know, even with a lockdown, like if we'd continued the November lockdown, we would almost certainly have continued to have increasing numbers of cases, increasing number of hospitalizations, and increasing numbers of deaths. And
by the way, we are seeing those now.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. And so it was extraordinarily worrying. It means, because we tend to use the term non-pharmaceutical interventions, and although for these, and although lockdowns is a sort of a catch-all phrase, the reality is that lockdown is a very, you know, means very different things. You know, it can be just pubs, restaurants are closed, shops are closed, or it could be everybody has to stay at home. It could mean, you know, and there's a difference between lockdowns with schools open and lockdowns.
Right. As we speak, we're in London and we're in a tier four lockdown, which means beauty salons, gyms, all of the main shopping centers, which were open just before Christmas, had to be closed.
Yeah.
But you can still go to work. You can still travel on public transit. They say if you need to, but you know, most people who want money will say that they need to.
Indeed.
So it's and you're not allowed to socialize with other households.
Yeah.
So that shut all of that Christmas three household mixing idea, that just shut it all down.
Yeah.
Do you think that is working now?
Yeah, and that was depressing, because actually, although a lot of my colleagues were arguing against having celebrations over Christmas, I was not one of them, because I felt that I felt the three family Christmas rule could have allowed us to manage Christmas safely and less of a risk than actually going about our normal daily lives earlier on in the month. But this new variant, of course, threw out.
What are you alarmed at beyond the replication number?
If we can't stop this disease, if whatever we do short of vaccination there's a number of things. The first is that, forgetting about vaccination at the moment, what this means is that case numbers will increase rapidly, no matter how strict our lockdowns are. And of course, lockdowns can't be ever totally strict. I mean, if we were able to enforce a rule that said, okay, for the next month, nobody at all is allowed to leave their house, then the virus would pretty much have disappeared, and may well have actually totally disappeared. The problem is that there'd be a lot of people dead from starvation, and the water supplies would have stopped working, and our electricity wouldn't be on, and all these other things which we need to keep us alive. So it's always has to be a balance between how restrictive you want to be and actually how do you keep society going at the lockdown.
And it seems to me it was an odd balance. It seems to me, watching this government in Britain and then also watching the Trump, I don't even want to characterize it, but I mean the Trump tragic, tragic comedy, that there was this idea of herd immunity in the beginning, and then they started to kind of get into this other system where, you know, they would lift the lid just until hospitals started to see those increased numbers, and they were worried about the hospitals getting overwhelmed, and then they would put it down. Whereas in Asia, the philosophy was very much shut it down, eliminate it, and then reopen. And in Western Europe and in America, Canada was a bit better where I'm from. Generally, though, it was, you know, let it simmer.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that was a mistake. And I think the we certainly didn't in this country do well enough to control this epidemic. And I think the fact that the new variant arose in the UK, there is nothing special about where new variants can arise. The only thing that drives whether or not you're going to get a new variant in one place or another is how much more disease you've got in one place or another. You know, the likelihood of getting a new variant appearing in a place is solely related to the number of infections. So if we'd managed to bring our infections lower during the summer and September, you know, if we'd got an effective test, track and trace that actually worked properly, if we'd been a little bit more cautious about opening up some of the hospitality venues and encouraging people to go on to go to restaurants during August on particular days, because that's when you got the half price meal and that's when it was really busy. We might not have actually had enough cases around to have actually kickstarted this, the English variant. But then, of course, there's the South African variant. So, you know, it wouldn't have necessarily.
Very, very quickly, just two more questions. One is, you said the English variant.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I was looking at the Center for Strategic Risks in America, and there are a lot of former defense officials and mm-hmm. people who have died who have dealt with the risk of biological warfare. Yeah. And I have a lot of respect for them, but they talked about the genome sequencing that takes place in the United Kingdom, and that there really isn't anything comparable to in other places, and that the US should have it, mm-hmm. but the number that they use in the United States, 0.3% of cases have been sequenced. In the United Kingdom, it's about 5 to 10% roughly.
Correct. Yes, yes.
The US is ranked 43 in the world, by the way, which I think is shocking.
But yeah.
So look, that may tell us, yeah, the UK is better at sequencing. Doesn't it also tell us that this variant, while it's really been identified in the United Kingdom and people are sealing their borders to the UK, it is probably much more widespread than we realize.
Yeah, it is now. But I think the balance of evidence is it probably started initially in the southeast of England, maybe Kent. But, you know, we can't say that for certain. You know, one of the things, as I'm sure you know about Kent, is that it's sort of quite close to the Channel Tunnel, and so that, you know, a lot of people,
where all the truck drivers pass through and stop.
So you can't exclude that it did, you know, but it certainly is spreading more widely. It's now in the States, it's now in Canada, it was in Australia, and it's I think most European countries where they've actually looked for it.
Do you, in your initial reaction, which you described as feeling physically ill when you saw the increasing R rates and realized this new variant had taken off, do you believe that we are battling the clock and that this variant, it is just a matter of time, because we're seeing mutations in the spike protein, which it attaches, the vaccines attach onto. If we don't roll out vaccines effectively, if this is not handled quickly and the lid put back on all of this, that the virus is simply going to outpace and outsmart the new vaccines?
No, you're quite right. I mean, at the moment, there is no evidence that it's made a big change to the ability of the vaccine to protect against that strain. The big problem, though, is that I've been saying this for some time, and probably one of the few people in the UK that has actually quoted as saying this for some time. But I was gratified to know that the chief scientist of the World Health Organization 2 days ago said exactly the same thing. We do not know whether any of the current vaccines actually stop infection. So it is certainly plausible that the vaccines, and I think the Oxford-AstraZeneca vaccine have actually looked at this, and the full dose, it didn't actually make that much difference to whether somebody gets an infection or not. But what it does is stop people or reduce the chances of people developing symptomatic infection.
Now I'm alarmed. Because what you're telling me is if it doesn't stop infection,
Yeah.
I'll let you continue on, but that means all of the social distancing, all of the mask wearing, all of that is going to have to continue because this vaccine will continue to circulate and continue to mutate and develop. And
eventually it will be the vaccine. That is certainly quite plausible. Yeah. And it may well be the case that although at the moment the spike proteins are still close enough for the vaccine to work, at some point, presumably, it's quite possible that we will get some mutation that is that's they're called escape mutants that no longer is controlled by the vaccine. But it shouldn't be that we won't have to go through the huge process that we've had to this year to modify the vaccines for any new mutation. But the issue is in people who don't have vaccine. If these vaccines don't stop transmission, although they'll almost certainly reduce the probability of transmission, even if they don't stop it. But if they don't stop it, then any concept of herd immunity from vaccination just evaporates. You know, and so that people who elect not to be vaccinated for whatever reason or can't because of pre-existing disease or whatever, they're still very much at risk of getting the infection, of getting severe disease and dying, depending on other risk factors and their age and so on. So, yeah, it is. And I think with this more infectious variant, that becomes even more difficult for people who don't have the vaccine. They're even more at risk of continuing to be getting the infection. So I think, to be honest, I can't, you know, I've been saying for months that, you know, I can see my grandchildren's grandchildren. Well, I won't be around then, but, you know, I strongly suspect that my grandchildren's grandchildren will still be getting infections with COVID-19, but they almost certainly will not be dying by then. And almost certainly the disease that they would experience won't be that much different from the common cold. And that is, and I'm saying that because we know that's happened at least twice in the past, where a very similar to virus to COVID-19 has got into human society, probably was responsible for large numbers of deaths for a few years. And then after that, it just sort of, we came to a situation where it was just the common cold.
But you're saying there's still some very difficult years potentially ahead of us, even though the UK health minister was on television this morning saying this is all going to be over in the spring. I mean, I think that is in the extreme.
I think that is overly optimistic, personally.
Yeah.
I think things will be a lot better by the spring. Don't get me wrong. You know, by the time we're into the spring, and people who are accepting of the vaccine have had the vaccine, that is going to make a huge difference. And I can't see next summer being anywhere near as difficult as this last year. And I'm totally expecting to be able to travel and go to meetings come next summer and September again.
I hope you're right. I'm watching President-elect Biden criticize the Trump rollout of the vaccine because this is a race against time, saying the way it's going, it will take years, not months. The UK government seems poised and they have promised a speedy, efficient rollout, but they have bungled everything up until now. So
they
prove us wrong. Dr. Paul Hunter, a professor of medicine at the Norwich School of Medicine, University of East Anglia. Great to talk to you, Paul. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And that's our Backstory, the last edition of 2020. We wish you well. Please subscribe to Backstory. I've now launched a new newsletter to help you digest and navigate the daily news. Because I think a lot of people, and people tell me, they don't know how to read daily news and watch television and figure out what's true and what's disinformation. Check it out, Dana Lewis's Backstory newsletter on Substack. I'll try to explain news and give you an idea how I source it and I'll even put the links there. In 2021, I'll continue to bring you weekly podcasts focusing on international news. Here's what the astrologers say about 2020. It was a cataclysmic aligning of planets that ends in the new year, thank goodness, and 2021 ushers in the age of Aquarius. What changes are astrologers predicting in 2021? If this year saw our regular ways of life upended, then next year is tipped to offer technological advancements and the mending of communities, they say. On December the 21st, 2020, Jupiter and Saturn met in Aquarius, and they'll remain in this sign for the majority of the year. Aquarius is a sign associated with abrupt change, forming communities, fighting for causes that you care about, and making technological advances. Anyway, that's what astrologers say. And I think I'll take any good news at this point. Thanks for listening to Backstory. I'm Dana Lewis in London, and I'll talk to you again soon on the other side in 2021.